in every business we've done, the cheaper, the smaller, or the bigger pain in the butts. It just is what it is.
So it's the opposite of what Biggie said when he said, more money, more problems. It's the opposite. Less money, bigger problems.
Welcome to Turning Profit, a podcast for people that love real estate. Learn the business models and skills that professional real estate investors use to make money and build wealth. Visit turningprofit.com for a wealth of investor resources. And now, here are your hosts, Pete and Heather Reese.
Welcome to the Turning Profit podcast. Heather, it's so great to be here once again.
Yeah, it's going to be a good episode.
It is. And today's episode is going to be called Inside the Business.
Sounded like you were going to be like, today's episode is sponsored by
No, us. It's not sponsored by
it's
anyone.
It's sponsored by us.
It's sponsored by Land Conquest.
Okay, there we go.
There we go.
We should say that, meaning us. There is no sponsor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's on purpose, because I think people have asked that before, like, how do we sponsor it?
Yeah, no, we don't need any sponsors. We do our own thing around here. We don't want any advertisers telling us what to do with our content.
That's funny. Yeah. That would never happen. But okay. Yeah, go for
all
it.
Right.
Hey, anyone who's doing that, that's cool. If you're making money that way.
Yeah.
Go you. But today's episode is all about...
Yeah, it's called Inside the Business. Mm-hmm. It's a study of our first 200 land flip deals.
Right. It's funny. We kind of already just went inside the business when we said we didn't have sponsors. So
yeah,
there we go.
True.
So, but what are we talking about?
Well, basically what we're doing, and this all comes from what I wanted to do this past weekend, was I took a morning, Saturday morning, and I sorted, you know, we've done over 200 deals now. So I took our first 200 deals that we've done. You know, I track everything on a spreadsheet, and I've got all this data about all these deals.
Real high tech.
What, a spreadsheet?
I'm just kidding.
Well, I use other tools as well, okay. But a spreadsheet is a good way to see kind of, you know, crunch some numbers and see kind of overall where things are at and just get some quick statistics on everything.
I threw you off your game there. You were taken aback by that.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with spreadsheets. I wouldn't run your whole business on spreadsheets, but they're a good tool to use for certain things.
Okay, definitely. We can call this episode In Defense of Spreadsheets. Yeah. So, but I think it's funny because last week, I say that a lot. I think it's funny. I don't actually think it's funny. It's interesting, right?
That's so funny.
It's interesting because last episode we were talking about, you know, I was like, run the numbers.
The leads.
Yeah, uh-huh. Kind of. And so anyway, I still want to do that, but this is actually more important because it has helped us make a big change just in the past couple hours that we've had this information. We've made a big shift. And I think that anyone else listening to this is going to kind of take that information and can run with it and not have to do 200 deals to figure out what has worked for us. Now, having said that, it might work different for somebody else.
Right.
But hopefully by having this information, they can make more educated decisions with their land flipping business. And again, people are going to probably wonder, like, why are you sharing this information? Like, doesn't that create more competition for you? Take it away.
No, I don't think so. No, I think rising tide raises all boats.
That's why I said take it away.
As John F. Kennedy would have said.
Last week.
Supposedly.
Huh? After he died, before he died. What? Huh?
It was a quote from him.
From him.
But then supposedly someone else said it before him. So anyhow.
Anyways,
I guess he's credited with saying it, yes.
And that's why I said you could take it away with that quote, because I knew you were going to say it and I didn't want to be the one to botch it or to misrepresent whoever it was.
Yeah, so, I like that quote.
I know. So we're going to be going to go into details on the first deals, revenue, gross profit. I'm looking at your cheat sheet here. And then you even break it down like top 10%, 20%, where we should be putting our money, where our efforts go, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And all this was done. I wanted to do this so I could get some insight into, okay, so what are the deals that are producing the most profit for us? What are the most impactful? So we can hopefully do more of those
and
less of the deals that are crappy.
Right. So. And before you actually ran the numbers, did what you learned, is that what you thought you were going to learn?
You know, I had an indication that's kind of what it was, but I didn't really know how impactful those things were.
Well, ready to get into it?
Let's go inside the business, Heather.
Okay, so today's episode is inside the business. Actually, inside the numbers of the business, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And this is in regards to the purchases that we're making and the price points of those purchases and the profit for those purchases.
Yeah, so I'll kind of explain what I did and then we'll start breaking down some of the numbers, some of the things that we learned from this study.
Okay.
So first of all, I took all of our deals, all 200 of our deals, and I sorted them by profit. how much absolute profit that we made on each of those deals. So
by percentage or
no, just actual by amount. Actual like okay. amount of profit. So one deal made 50,000 and then 40,000, you know, so it, mm-hmm. there was a list like that. So I sorted it all by that. And then what I did was I took different, you know, I calculated some of the total numbers, like the total profit we made, the total revenue we made, the total, you know, lots of these things, which I'll go into. But then I also tried to do a study like, okay, so I looked at the top 10% of those deals and what's in common with those top 20%, top, you know, so I was trying to figure out, you know, you hear so much about the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. You know,
thank
so
you
like,
for breaking that down for me.
Well, you know, I'm not breaking it down for you.
No,
I'm
you need because I didn't know the
Pareto principle.
I know 80-20 rule, but not
okay. So I had assumed, or I was thinking that okay, there's probably 20% of the deals that are producing 80% of the profit. Mm-hmm. Now, in reality, that wasn't what happened here. It's about 50% of our deals are 80% of our profits.
Okay, well, so that's still significant.
It's still yeah. significant. Uh-huh. So basically, 100 of the deals are 80, I'll go into specific, over 80% of our mm-hmm. profit margin.
And then another 50% are only 20% of the deals.
Yeah, less than 20%.
Right, which
yeah.
sucks.
Yeah, which sucks.
So, because it's assuming that's the same amount of money we're putting out, the same amount of effort.
Probably of more everything. Effort if you've right. been following along, because those deals like that are the ones that are take up some of your time and give you so many headaches and all that stuff.
I wish people talked about that more, that the smaller deals are the ones that are, I mean, in every business we've done, the cheaper, the smaller are the bigger pain in the butts.
Right.
And all around, it just is what it is.
So it's the opposite of what Biggie said when he said, mo money, mo problems. Isn't he the one that said that? It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. Less money, bigger problems.
Right. And in real estate, we've talked about before, that can be a number of reasons. It can be just an uneducated, I don't mean uneducated in the sense of full education, but in the processing, people who haven't done as many real estate deals on both sides, buyers, sellers, investors, there's more issues, more static comes up because people are nervous. They don't know the right steps. They make mistakes. They're trying to put deals together that aren't deals. There's lots of reasons. But even if you check aside that, it just makes more sense that if you a bigger deal that makes more money, let's say you make $100,000 on one deal and you're normally making 20,000, that's five deals to make that same 100,000.
Right.
So that still makes more, you know what I mean? Like yep. even is the effort five times what, you know, no, it's not normally.
Yeah.
So go on.
All right. I'm going to go over some big numbers, you know, like mm-hmm. from totaling up these lists and everything and all of our top 200 deals, just so you can get a reference point. Total revenue. We have done $13,380,043 total revenue in our first 200 deals. Okay?
Okay.
That's a lot of money. Total gross profit we've done is $5,702,251. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's a gross profit margin of about 42.6%. Now when I say gross profit, what I'm looking at here is just the property specific expenses and everything. You know, we're not looking at expenses for our business as a whole, you know, with our staff, our marketing, software, any other business type of overhead that's not kind of calculated in that. So we see $5.7 million in gross profit. That's not actually what we brought home at the end of the day. But
right.
But that's a property, like what those properties mm-hmm. generated.
Right. And that's important to know because first of all, I don't want anyone thinking, okay, I can just do this. And, you know, we still paid a lot of money in marketing to right. get to that.
Right.
The other reason that we don't include that is that it's hard to break down our staff. Like, okay, you spent an hour on this one at this, it would just be impossible right. for us. So we look at this number. And also that could be convoluted too, because what if there was actual, you know, on one of these properties, it took more staffing hours because there was some sort of title issue or something. That doesn't really make sense to include for when we're thinking of what we want to do our outreach for.
Right.
So it's important to keep it separate.
That's right. And maybe you're a solopreneur and you're doing everything yourself. And then obviously you don't have to pay staff costs and all these other things that we've got. So
right.
we're reinvesting a lot of our profits back into our business to grow it, to do bigger and bigger things. So we wanted to do $20 million in mm-hmm. revenue in 2024. So, you know, we're gearing up to do that.
Right.
So.
And we're staff heavy
yes.
in anticipation of that. So we're
basically building a team for where we're going, not where we're at right now.
Which is cool. It yeah. does cut down on the profits significantly, right. but we're thinking it'll pay off at the end.
That's right.
Okay.
As Wayne Gretzky said, skate to where the puck is going, not to where it's been.
As Heather,
not the word is.
Heather Delaney Reese said, put you in your quotes, so you're on
yeah,
fire.
Yeah, I'm on fire with this. Okay. So anyhow, those are kind of the big numbers. So in total, we spent $7,207,821 in order to bring in $13,380,043. So when you look at it that way, we put that much towards properties in order to get put in 7.2 to get 13.3 back, something so like that.
It's close to doubling,
kind yeah, of. Yeah, yeah. So it's a 42.6% gross profit margin, so okay, to be
thank
exact.
Thank you for doing that math for me.
Okay, so here are kind of the things that we were calculating after we sorted this list of our 200 deals. So I was looking at average days in inventory, which overall, our average days in inventory of all the properties we sold, 92.64 days.
Right. It's interesting because there's a few. I wonder if we did. What is it when in college when they would take off the top and the bottom?
The outliers.
Mm-hmm. But what's it called? Where you graded the. You know, did you end up doing that?
Well, I've got the median. So the median where you basically put the list in order and then you take the middle.
Right. But there was. I remember they did it on a curve. So you would take off, right?
Oh, isn't okay.
That, so I went because I know that there's some that were really quick. Mm-hmm. But then there were some that were long that really messed up the thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's if you took off both of those, that would still be shorter. Mm-hmm. I think you'd be much closer to the 60.
Yeah,
day
I
mark.
Probably should have calculated the median days in inventory to kind of account for that, because that basically takes them all and you just look at the middle.
Right.
So
yeah.
But I didn't do that for average days in inventory for some reason. I did that for gross profit and everything else. So you can see how that changes. So it basically takes away those outliers, you know what I mean? So they're not as relevant, I guess. Mm-hmm. Okay, so average gross profit per deal. That's another metric. Overall, it was $28,654 per deal on
not
average.
Bad. Yeah.
Right? Median gross profit per deal, basically when we're cutting out those outliers, both high and low, it was $20,702 per deal.
So when I look at that, I think, okay, right around 25,000 is what our, you know.
Okay, so our average, also, we looked at average purchase price. Mm-hmm. So our average purchase price overall, $36,403. Median purchase price, you know, getting rid of those outliers again, we're talking, it was $25,907.
That's interesting, because I would have thought it was higher.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey everyone, just a quick reminder that you can join our community for free at landconquest.com. Inside, you'll get all the resources, training, and support for building a thriving land flipping business. Once again, that's landconquest.com. All right, enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, also, we took a look at average revenue per deal. Mm-hmm. So our average revenue per deal, $66,905. So I guess on average, we bought properties for $36,400 and average on revenue, we sold them for $66,900.
That makes sense. That sounds about right.
Yeah. And if you look at the median revenue per deal was $53,681. So if you're looking at the medians, we did $25,000 on the purchase, $53,000 on the resale. So
all of these are about, like, our target number is always about 50%. And then it comes in 42.
Yeah, that's higher. What we're trying to do. We're trying to double it. Mm-hmm. So whether it happens or not, you know.
Yeah, but if you look at this, you're getting close. Yeah. Like that's not an offshoot. Like, that's not saying, like, I'm going to make $5 billion and making a million. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
$5
billion. $5
billion. Okay,
I'll
sure.
I'll take $5
billion. I do that, though. That's my go-to is $5 billion and
Yeah. Then we broke this list down by, like, the top 10% of these transactions, top 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, and then also looked at the bottom 50%, bottom 20%, bottom 10%. And after I did a lot of work manually trying to calculate all these numbers and everything on my spreadsheets, Heather suggested that I use ChatGPT.
Just walked in and I saw you. You're like, I've been spending hours doing it. I'm like,
and I was like 90% done. I was like, damn it. yes, I should have thought about that. And it took me hours. But then what I did is I formatted the list. And then, you know, and then it was like, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to upload this list to ChatGPT and then start asking it questions. Mm-hmm. And it was cool because I basically formatted it the way they wanted to see it. They wanted to see it as a text file. So I did it as a CSV file and I uploaded it. And I'm like, hey, analyze it. And I kind of prepped it. And I said, I'm trying to do some studies about this. I'm going to ask you some questions. And anyhow, so it was kind of cool because it has all the data. And then I was asking it questions about, like, okay, so what are the most profitable types of deals? What are, you know, like, so I was asking all kinds of different things. And sometimes the answers were a little bit not what I was looking for, but then I would restate things and ask it to redo it again. And overall, it came back with some pretty interesting insights. I was asked, because we also had data about the states that all these properties were in and things like that. So I was able to ask some questions about, like, you know, what are the best states? What are the ones to stay away from? What are, you know, like all these types of things. So
that would actually be really interesting to help our marketing department and our sales department and stuff understand these things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like sharing that and letting them ask it.
Yeah. All that data is uploaded. So I could go back to now and ask it more questions.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, though, is that, yeah, it sucked that you didn't use ChatGPT in the beginning, but I feel like there's a lot of value in just the inputting of this because you're forced to look at it.
Yeah.
And I guess you still had to create the information for it to interpret or to analyze, I guess. But I still think that there was a lot, like, it wasn't lost that you spent time doing that.
No, it wasn't lost. I mean, it was good to really dive into it. But the other thing that you just mentioned, I think is probably lost by a lot of people, is the fact that we track all this stuff. Like, we have this spreadsheet, so it's like there and we're keeping it updated continuously. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at it, we're adjusting, we're doing all this stuff. And if I didn't have this and I would try to go back and like recreate this stuff for 200 deals, it would have been a monumental task.
Right.
Would never happen.
Right. So. And that's another thing on why the bookkeeping is so important to stay on top of it, because you can't, what's your saying again? You can't value what you can't, what is it? You can't improve.
You can't manage what you don't measure.
Right. So, and it's like so important, because we wouldn't have known like any of this mm-hmm. had, you know, that not happened.
So, you know, I've got a lot of insight from ChatGPT and also from just kind of looking at the numbers and sort of making my drawing to some conclusions. The top 100 of our deals were 81.69% of our profit. Half of our deals mm-hmm. were over 80% of our profits. Not the 80-20 rule, but it still is significant for sure. You know,
it still proves that whole theory that there's going to be a chunk of your profit is going to come from a smaller percentage of your sales than you think.
Yeah. You know, I was guessing maybe it was the 80-20% mm-hmm. because I hear that so much, but it wasn't quite that, but it still is definitely very significant. Mm-hmm. And it was about 73.76% of the revenue. Now, I track revenue a lot, and that's kind of the big number that everyone likes to see and stuff like that. But really, it's about the profit, you know? So profit's way more important than the revenue. Obviously, revenue is important for cash flow and things like mm-hmm. that. But when you break it down, it's about the profit.
I don't even look at the revenue. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people really are interested in that. Like, oh, our sales were blah, blah, blah. Like, okay, congratulations.
Kind of a vanity number in some ways.
It's 100% a vanity mm-hmm. number. And then talk about like, oh, it's a, you know, the company has revenue, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's great. But that could be a losing company. Mm-hmm. That could be a company on the verge of bankruptcy.
Right.
That doesn't matter. It's all, to me, it's all about the profit.
Yeah, you could have $20 million in revenue, but you're losing $2 million a year.
Right. So.
Next, talking about the bottom 100 deals. Now, the bottom 100 deals were 18.39% of our profit.
Do we have some like dread music that can be played? I feel like that's
necessary. Sure that can be edited dun, dun, in. Maybe dun, I'll yeah. do some sort of sound
we keep
effect
saying
here.
That and you haven't.
I'm scared to press one of these buttons and we'll be on some sort of robot voice or something like that
that's
for the rest
fun.
Of the episode. Okay, bottom 100 deals, 18.39% of our profit. That kind of stinks.
So 50% of our deals only brought in 18% of mm-hmm. our income. Yeah, that sucks.
Right.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's 100 deals. 100 mm-hmm. deals were only 18% of our profit. And it was about 26% of the revenue. Okay, so I'm going to take a look at, I've just done some summary stuff here. So I'm going to be looking at the top 100 deals, and I'm going to kind of summarize the details on that. I'm going to look at the bottom 100 deals, kind of summarize some things on that. And then the bottom 20% of the deals, the real stinkers, the crappy deals, there's 40 there that just are kind of embarrassing to look at. But I'm going to talk about them anyhow, so just so you all can help, can avoid those types of deals in the future. And and hopefully that will allow me to do that as well.
I don't see this number on here, so I just kind of calculated it. But anyways, I took our total revenue was $13,380,000, whatever, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I multiplied it by 18.39% because that was the profit.
Mm-hmm.
So 50% of our deals brought in. Did you already do this?
It's not on here, but I think I have it on the sheet here on this one, the actual spreadsheet one.
Yeah, it says like if you look at the whole thing, so it's only $13 million in profit. Mm-hmm. I rounded down, whatever. That means that 50% of the deals brought in only $2 million of that. The other 50% brought in like $11 million.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you look at it,
well, the profit was 5.7. not 13.
I'm talking about gross revenue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that, if you look at the gross revenue, that really puts it in perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like 13 million and whatever was the gross profit. Mm-hmm. And then if we cut it, the
gross revenue.
Gross revenue. Jeez. Yes. Gross revenue. Yeah. Yeah, whatever. That's it, the 80-20 kind of thing. If you broke that down, but in our case, 50-50, 50% of that brought in, mm-hmm. you know, what, over 11 million, and the 50% only brought in 2.4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like as far as profit mm-hmm. goes, like the bottom 50% of mm-hmm. our deals were $1 million in gross profit, and the top 100 deals were 4.65 million.
Okay, so if you look at it that way, do you instantly say like, nah, we should use that money for somewhere else? Or something else? Or do you say...
It's tough.
Because it's like $1 million is still $1 million. So right. like we should shut up.
Right.
Or shut the up.
Yeah, I think there's a balance. Yeah. And I wanted to get into that with you here at the end here too. I mean, these, you know, when you look at this, you would think, okay, it's pretty clear we should only be doing like the deals mm-hmm. in the top 100. Mm-hmm. But then you look at this and you say, okay, the bottom 100 deals made us $1 million in profit. Mm-hmm. Should we just throw those out?
Well, because then if I take into account that there's still the same manpower, mm-hmm. there's still the same resource use, what's our actual profit in that? Mm-hmm. I mean, then because then you look at it, maybe we should. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should be like, nope, we're not doing it because we probably are. I mean, it's great to say, oh, $1 million, but that's not exactly what we're like depositing.
That's true.
You know, it's not like I have $1 million sitting in the bank from these deals. I don't. Mm-hmm. So I probably have way more in the bank from the $4 million in deals than I do in the $1 million of deals. Mm-hmm. So it might actually be also a resource suck. That $1 million might be taking resources away from the team that could be put towards the $4 million profit area.
Mm-hmm. And I guess some of it comes down to the capacity of your team as well. Like how mm-hmm. much additional capacity do you have?
Right.
Like if your team members are just sitting around doing nothing, then
it makes sense
to mm-hmm. you know at least be working on some things that are generating some profit. So it's a balance, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it's a balance. So
right. And maybe that means, too, we'll get through all these other numbers, but just as a kind of midpoint, maybe that we separated it now that we understand it, then we really analyze that lower 50%. Well, first of all, we analyze the top part mm-hmm. and say, how do we get more of these deals? Because that's a no-brainer.
Right.
I hate saying no-brainer to people who don't have brains. Sorry. I'm just jealous
of your people with no brains.
They're not okay. listening to this. Okay. I know. Maybe they are. I don't know. But so, you know, it goes. Just cut that out.
Let's keep it in. Keep it in. Oh,
this is embarrassing. I'm just jealous of your coffee. But I think that it shows that when we're analyzing these things, and right now we're obviously just having a conversation. You guys are just listening in because this is the first time Pete and I have really talked about it. But I think that we really need to analyze both sides of that. And if we can max out the team on the top end, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then we find another use for the bottom ones. They're still valuable.
Right.
But they're not as valuable.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a balance, and you know, maybe as we're analyzing this, and we'll go through this a little bit more, but definitely we should be cutting out, I think, some of the deals which we know from the beginning are not going to be super profitable deals, and then they end up being kind of a drag, and you know, like this top the bottom 20%, which we're going to get into, it's kind of, you know, it's really pathetic, some of the numbers there.
That's good.
But maybe we projected higher on some of those as well than we actually achieved. So
right. And those are talking points. And maybe you get with the team and we analyze this and say, okay, where did we go wrong? Mm-hmm. And if by where did we go wrong and you're the only person that made that decision, then you need to get with yourself and decide.
Is that what you're trying to say, Heather? Where did I? Because those were all my decisions. But I learned from them.
Yeah. I mean, there's value in all that.
Let's go back into the numbers. We'll circle back to this conversation. We'll circle back. Anyhow.
I hate that phrase. That's why we'll circle back.
Okay. Top 100 deals. Okay. Here's kind of the average. Here's the numbers for the top 100 deals. Okay. Average gross profit on those top 100 deals, mm-hmm. $46,580. Median gross profit from the first 100 deals, $35,870. Mm-hmm. All right. Average purchase price, $47,841. Median purchase price, $45,000. Pretty similar there. Average resale price, $98,695. Median resale, $85,787. And when we're looking at the average days on the market, 77.94 days. Mm-hmm. And then, again, this is 81.69% of our profit and 73.76% of the revenue. from that, we can kind of make some generalizations that, like, hey, we're on average, we're buying these properties for like $45,000. And we're reselling them for $85,000 to $100,000 in that range. That's kind of characteristic of a typical deal in the top 100, I guess.
When we first started, I liked when you did the cheaper ones, like the $10,000 profit. I mean, $10,000, $15,000 purchase price, and then you sold it for $25,000, $30,000. Mm-hmm. I really liked those. Those felt safe to me. If I lost $15,000 because I was still in, you know, unsure of everything. Mm-hmm. It felt like, okay, that was fine. We can handle it. It felt like someone would buy a property for $30,000. Like this, mm-hmm. It just felt like those were safe numbers. As you have gotten more into it, this is the range that I feel more comfortable with. And I've said that over and over again, like the under $50,000, like the 45 to 50,000, that felt actually like the safest range.
Yeah.
Like I really liked that one. And then they sold quick. And it makes sense because a lot of these people that are buying it, or most of them, wouldn't you say they're cash?
Yeah, they're cash. They're mostly cash.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's someone who's refinanced their home in the past few years, saved up. $100,000 is not like a million. Like it used to be $100,000, used to be a lot. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a lot, but I'm saying that in this realm, there's a big difference between someone buying a $100,000 property and someone buying even a $150,000 property.
Yeah.
It's funny that over time, my thoughts on this has changed, like the more information I've had, because I thought for sure that those were going to be the profitable, the fastest, the least headache. To me, that seemed like, wow, those are actually not cheapo properties at $15,000 purchase, because I was thinking a cheapo property is like $5,000 or something cheapo. I use that word. It doesn't really mean that, but you know what I mean? Cheapo. Like cheapo. But I wouldn't have known that unless we started doing some analyzing over the past few years, right?
Right.
But now with this information, that's exactly, it's true. Like yep. Those are the right, and if you look at the logistics of it, it makes sense. That's the whole thing. You know, it's a lot easier to sell a $100,000 property than it is a $250,000 property if you're talking cash only. And there's not a lot of like land loans out there.
Mm-hmm.
They're normally like wrap loans with a mobile home or a house or construction or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, do you run across a lot that are just straight financing for land?
There are, you know, we do get some mm-hmm. deals that are, you know, people get land loans, you know, they're putting like 30% down, something like that. But I do want to mention something. You mentioned that, like the $250,000 properties, like some of those actually You're sell right. pretty quickly.
You're right.
So
yeah,
if they're a premium property, they sell pretty quickly. Actually, it's the ones that are on the lower end, as you'll see from this mm-hmm. next thing that we're going into, they tend to actually sell slower. And
I think the issue with the $250,000 ones is they're harder to get.
They are harder to get. You have less of them, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. There's just less of them. And a lot of those are some kind of development. They're not necessarily like for someone to build a home on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I mean,
or
a
larger kind of acreage tracts yeah. or something like that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, because really, if I should back my comment up, those we would do every day of the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because those are actually really
I like
good.
Those, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a chunk of money. It's profitable. It's that whole thing where, yeah, we could sell 2.5 of this one or just one of those.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Are you looking to scale your land flipping business quickly? Well, we're happy to present our new cutting edge system built specifically for land flippers. Take a look at the Land Conquest business system today, and you'll gain full access to a customizable pre-made website, CRM, dedicated phone numbers, text automations, 24/7 support, and more. It's basically a business in the box. Go to software.landconquest.com to learn more.
Okay, so what's the next
okay,
step?
Okay, so next, let's talk about the bottom 100 deals. These are the ones that are, and after that, we'll even go into the bottom 20% of deals. Yeah, painful. So these are kind of characteristics of these bottom 100 deals as a whole. Average gross profit, $10,442. Median gross profit, $10,751. So no real difference there. Average purchase price, $24,431. Median purchase price, $18,496. So as a whole, you know, these are kind of the cheaper mm-hmm. properties. Average resale price, $35,114. Median resale price, $29,603. Average days on market, 107.34 days.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's basically a month longer than the top mm-hmm. 100 deals. And then this represents 18.39% of the profit and 26.24% of the revenue.
It's weird because that's only like a $20,000 difference from
mm-hmm. yeah.
the purchase price, but I can see it. I wonder also if there's less motivation on all sides because as it gets, the price gets cheaper, agents don't make as much.
Yeah. That's true.
Maybe even some closing places. Normally it's a flat fee, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe to them, it's just kind of like not as big of a deal.
Yeah.
Because to them, even though they're making the same amount of money, they're thinking, well, it's just a cheap property. I'll get to it when I get to it.
You know, I think the big thing is, you know, probably if I'm being honest with myself, some of these cheaper properties, mm-hmm. they probably have some issues, you know, why they're cheap.
Mm-hmm. It's
you
know, not or, just the size.
Yeah, maybe not just the size. Maybe it's just like, okay, we knew that this property isn't premium for this reason. Mm-hmm. Still bought it anyway because I realized it was really cheap to me. And maybe in hindsight, some of those weren't the best deals to do.
It's just harder to overcome that.
Right.
Right.
And so maybe, even though it has value,
right.
it's not as big of a buyer pool.
And I wonder, too, if someone's looking at like, okay, I want this 5-acre piece of property and I can buy it for $35,000. I'm getting a discount because there's, well, give me an issue.
There's a lot of slope.
Okay, there's a lot of slope. But I really want to live there. But I could also wait and spend another $25,000 and get one that's got...
That's flat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not on the side of a
it's
hill.
Not,
yeah.
It has to be a really good motivation for them to... You know, I mean, it has to be so cheap that they're like, well, this is... I can live there. Or you're targeting somebody who doesn't have as much money that it's their one way in.
Yeah, yeah. Like that's... They're stretching to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way they're going to be able to get a piece of land or something like that. Yeah.
We talk about that over and over again. And I feel like I stress it too much, but like, don't force a deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that comes down to it. Like, okay, it's cheap, but it needs to be the prime lot in the... I mean, we keep saying, but if it's cheap enough, buy it anyways. But maybe not. Maybe not. Or maybe we take off more than we normally do and say, hey.
And maybe part of the problem was on some of these deals, I was overly optimistic. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of them, I started out higher on what we were trying to sell it for. Mm-hmm. And I didn't completely factor in as much as I should have the downsides of some of these things.
Right. So. Well, we can tell the days on the market you were chasing it down.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reducing, you know, in most all of these cases, in a lot of them, mm-hmm. at least I was reducing the price every so often mm-hmm. because I knew that at some point someone's going to buy it mm-hmm. and I would leave it at a certain price on the market, you know, and then if there weren't any takers, then I knew we were still too high.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the way it works.
And really when we talk about it, like, oh, you hear people do this all the time with their house. Oh, my house is worth $2 million or whatever. No, it's not. It's
right.
Your house is worth whatever someone will pay for your house.
Yeah.
So you do your best estimate, but you have no idea. And if an agent says, I can definitely sell it for this, unless they have a buyer lined up, they're lying.
Cause yeah.
they should say, I really feel like it'll sell for this.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is what I want to do. I think I can get, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay. Now I'm getting depressed already. So.
Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of the summary. I mean, we're learning from this and, you know, we've learned a lot from all these 200 deals and, you know, it's been kind of exponential in a way. So
are you saying this for my benefit or theirs?
Everyone's benefit.
Okay.
Everyone's benefit. If you don't learn from your mistakes, then you're just destined to repeat them, I guess.
I think it's doomed. Those who don't learn from their mistakes are doomed to repeat them.
Yes, that's the quote. Whoever said that, I appreciate that. So anyhow, next, let's go into the bottom 20% of the deals. These are the crap deals. These are the ones.
Do you want to use this as like the thumbnail? Like,
oh, yeah. Like the ones that I wish I could have back. These were 40 deals that were in this category, 20% of 200, 40 deals.
This is horrible.
Right. 3.5% of the profits. So if we could have just lopped these, you know, bottom 20% off, bottom 20% of the deals, it would have been great because mm-hmm. this would have, you know. Anyhow, 3.5% of profits, mm-hmm. 7.06% of revenue. Our average gross profit on these deals, $5,014. Average purchase price of these deals, $21,799. Average days in inventory, 145 days.
That's so weird because this is not that big of a difference. Mm-hmm. Like when I look at this and it's like average purchase price of the tier above it is $24,000.
Mm-hmm.
This one's only $21,000.
Oh, I need to look at what was the average resale price of these.
What's funny though, because you're talking about the top 100 deals that had an average purchase price of $47,000.
Mm.
So that's a $23,000 drop to the lower. So there, that, okay, that's a big chunk. I can look at that and I can be like, okay, that makes sense. This one is so small, 24 to, is that even clinically, is that even significant? Like 21 to 24, I guess.
Yeah.
It is in the realm of that this is, you know, what percentage is that? But just kind of like eyeballing it, it doesn't seem like it's that much.
Yeah. So the average resale price on these was $23,632. So
which is average purchase price of $21,000.
Yeah.
Average sale price of $23,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know how that equates to $5,000 in gross profit on average, but it somehow does.
Yeah, that might be something we can go back and ask ChatGPT, but didn't it help with your daughter's homework too, math homework?
Well, I asked it to kind of, I was struggling with one concept that I've never done, or maybe I did it a long time ago, and I was like, okay, solve this problem, but show me the work. So then right. I could see what the steps were.
So why are kids not using, because the teachers thought they were getting away from like, oh, I can prove that you're not using a calculator,
because
you have to show me the work.
Uh-huh.
If ChatGPT can show you the work.
Well, I just think that education needs to evolve. I mean, because these tools are going to be available to all these kids. So why not just kind of incorporate that into it?
Like, show me how you would get the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's the thing. Because it used to be like, you're not going to have a calculator when you're in the middle of the Sahara Desert and you have to save mm-hmm. yourself by doing this word problem. Yeah, that's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
Show them how to ask that, you know, AI programs to figure out the stuff that they need.
Right. How to use a tool.
Right.
You know, like no different than how to use a hammer.
Right.
You know, you got to know how to use a tool to get the job done.
Right. And maybe go back to like help them understand what it's like to buy their first house. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Critical thinking and everything is mm-hmm. obviously very important. Problem solving, all that kind of stuff. But this stuff that they have them learning in eighth grade math, I mean, unless you're going to be an engineer or some sort of scientist, something like that, you're never, ever going to use anything remotely close to that in your real life or in your day job or whatever the case may be. So maybe there needs to be a little bit more effort put into specializing, you know, based off on the path of the particular student, because mm-hmm. it's completely pointless to be teaching them some of this stuff. So
right, two things. She really likes her math teacher, so it's okay. If her math teacher hears this, she thinks he's pretty cool.
That's right. I'm just good. But, this is my own commentary.
No, but the other part of that is that I think that the focus should be more on teaching them how to problem solve and to think of problems that we don't even know that we need solving, instead of just solving problems that have already been solved mm-hmm. a million times over and over again. Teach them the concepts and how to use technology, which will be available. I thought we were going to get taken away by like sinkholes. I don't know if that was a big thing. And what are the mirages?
Quicksand
and mirages. Like,
okay.
I was scared to death of that in third grade because like my teacher was like, if you are ever in the, you know, the Death Valley and you see that, don't.
Yeah.
I have still yet to find myself in Death Valley. You know what I mean?
Well, you drive through there on the way to Vegas.
Yeah. Well, and thankfully I haven't had to stop, but there's also 5 gazillion people there that hopefully would throw a bottle of water at me. So.
Well, if you stop in Baker, you can get a bottle of water at the convenience store.
There we go.
With a big thermometer.
Thermometer, yeah.
By the way, that was for sale a number of years ago. And I remember seeing it on LoopNet and being like, we got to buy that.
Yeah, and then I was like, and what will we do with it? Like,
buy the giant thermometer on the way to Vegas?
That's when you sell the naming rights to it, like to different companies. Like,
see, that's that the smart way been. To do it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then you have the actual, you set up some sort of like online betting about what the temperatures, like that's what we always did.
Mm-hmm.
We would do when the kids were little, when we were driving out there, they had to guess what the temperature, we'd tell them, okay, we're 10 miles away and here's the temperature on the car. What's it going to say on the thingy?
Yes.
And then whoever got closest got to pick where we'd eat dinner that first
yeah,
night.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun.
I don't know. It just shows though that the numbers are super important.
I mean, one last thing about the drive to Vegas thing, if you'll indulge for one second, I always used to think like, I'm going to buy one of these pieces of land along there and then do something absurd that everyone's going to notice and which will lead to advertising opportunities or naming rights or something like that. Like mm-hmm. world's biggest golf ball or world's biggest something. You know what I mean?
Well,
and it's just there along the side of the road.
Right. Well, if we're actually saying other road trip things, if someone's looking for another business to start, when we were in Europe, we stopped at a gas station and it had the world's best food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is like a rest stop type thing. Uh-huh. And it was the coolest thing. This is in Austria.
Austria. Okay. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I was just there for the bathrooms, but we walked in and our tour driver, I guess driver was like, hey, get some food while you're here. I was like, I just have to use the restroom. And I walked in, went to the left, and these bathrooms were like super, super clean. Like it was set up for this. There was a gas station. There was an animal area. There was a play yard, all this kind of stuff. He's like, you should grab something to eat. I'm like, I'm not hungry. And I looked and then I look over. I'm like, oh my God. It was like the most impressive
quality food. It was cafeteria style, uh-huh. but it was like really like the desserts, everything. It was amazing.
You know, was insane.
If they did something like that in the United States, in California or something like that, right. It would be like off the chain busy, like crazy busy.
Oh yeah. And so. It was because you couldn't stop. I think we got Emily ice cream and it was fresh gelato is actually what it was. There was fresh fruits that were already cut up. There was comfort food. I mean,
it was kind of like a smorgasbord.
Yes, that's what it reminded me of.
You just paid for your food individually.
Right. Like that, so. But we don't, I mean, like a buffet.
Buffet.
Of sorts out here. But a smorgasbord does feel different because on the East Coast, it was, especially in Lancaster, it was more quality, like home cooking. And that's what this felt. I mean, the food there out there tastes better. Like the fruits and vegetables have more flavor in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's their different standards, whatever. But yeah, if you're looking for something like that, you get a piece of land and you build something like that where it's, you know, you're forced to, you have to stop on the way to Vegas. Most people do. I don't know. Maybe you have an ironclad bladder. I don't. So I'm forced to stop or get gas or whatever. I know you have an electric car, so not your problem. That would be such an amazing business model to bring out here.
Yeah.
And if you do, please let me know so I can be the first guest there. Please have vegan food. So
you could be an investor, Heather.
I would be an investor.
I would invest too.
We've looked at, we are actually open to that if you've got some sort of other business ideas.
Yeah, we're open to investing. Mm-hmm. It's got to be good. So
unique, something that's moving ahead
with the times. Software, anything, anything you got.
Yeah.
Let me know. Email me. All right. So we're talking about the bottom 20% of the deals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the conclusion here is that, you know, we probably want to steer away from some of these cheaper deals going forward. And, you know, the best range, I guess, when you were just kind of looking at these general numbers as a whole is, you know, if we're projecting a profit of 40,000 plus per deal. So that's what's that's what kind of the averages show for those top 100 deals.
So you're taking this information, you're saying, irregardless of like pricing, whatever, we need to be trying to make at least double our money, make at least $40,000. Or are you looking at it and you're saying, I shouldn't do the cheaper deals at all? What? How are you looking at that?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of looking at both sides of things. So I'm thinking like, okay, so for our marketing, for our outreach, our direct mail and everything like that, I'm going to focus more on these types of properties where we're buying them for $40,000, $50,000 and trying to double our money on them. So those are the most impactful deals. On the other side, you know, we get leads coming in from other sources as well, you know, meaning pay-per-click and all this kind of stuff. And I really want to stay away from the deals that are less than $10,000 projected profit for sure.
So
and maybe we cut that off a lot higher than that as well.
Do you think that in our pay-per-click ad, like advertising, we should say if you have a property over...
Yeah, maybe there's some things that we could do to kind of discourage some of the people that have like less valuable type properties.
I wonder, because a lot of people would probably say like, oh, but mine is.
Right. Yeah, I think we'll get a lot of that. And that'll happen. But it's just a filtering process, you know, when it comes to leads and potential deals and all that kind of stuff. So, and I mean, I guess another takeaway is the longer that we hold the deals, the less profitable we are. But on the other hand, we might be holding them too long because they're crappier properties and we were off on our projection of what they were actually worth.
So should you drop the price quicker? Maybe you do like an initial one and then an initial one. And then after that, you really get rid of it.
Yeah, and definitely I could have been doing a better job. I didn't have a systemized process a lot of times because I've been handling the marketing side of things like all myself. Mm-hmm. Like we've got, you know, nearly 50 active listings at this point. So it's hard for me to juggle all that. We brought on another team member recently who's going to be on top of that, like based off some set parameters that we've got. So no,
if you didn't have a deadbeat wife like me that was helping, right?
Yeah, deadbeat Heather.
No, I think it's, you know, that goes back to why we have the team is that we need it. There's only so much time in the day. And if you're sitting there and you're looking at stale inventory, yeah, you want to get to it, but that's not as pressing as something that's going to bring in income right now.
Yeah, and that's kind of what way I've always skewed. It's always been more exciting for me to look at potential new deals and all this kind of stuff rather than...
Or you just have to. I'm pulling up our questions right now.
Right.
So yeah, are we good with this?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're good. And maybe we'll do some more analysis of these things in future episodes. Let us know in the comments if there's any other questions that you had or something like that. And maybe we can address that in a future episode.
Yeah, and if you find these interesting, I find it interesting because it helps me actually learn about our business. And if we're going to do it on the podcast, it forced you to actually sit down and do that. Like it makes you so that we can provide that. So, okay. So Clay says double close.
Oh, first of all, before you get into these, questions are from our community, which can be found at landconquest.com. This is our land flipping community. As of this film, we've got over 2,400 members in our community. And as of this moment, we are giving away, or we are providing a extensive training program for free. Mm-hmm. In our community.
Which is also free to join, by the way, because I don't know if we say that. But
yeah, the community is free to join. Okay. And this training program is completely free to all the members in there right now. I have to be honest, I'm actually in the process of reevaluating that right now. I'm thinking about maybe charging for it.
Really?
So if you're in the community, if you're thinking about getting in the community, go through the course quickly because, I mean, I just feel that a lot of people don't take it seriously because it's free. Mm-hmm. I haven't made any sort of decision yet, but... I honestly am thinking about that.
Okay, well, I like money, so I wouldn't be opposed to it.
I still would charge a price that's quite a bit less than what other comparable programs and stuff are charging. So
it wouldn't be like a $20,000 program. You wouldn't charge that even if the value was there. You'd do it more more accessible, if you will. If I get more people to do it, and we talked about this, why did we give it away in the first place? It's because we have other ways that we make money, and if we train you properly to be, you know, a successful land broker, we both benefit. So that was the whole thing going into it. But if it would make people take it more seriously, and for some people, they just think that things that are free that don't have value.
Right. Yeah.
So,
That's the feeling I get. Like, I just don't think many people take it seriously because they give it away for free.
Right. And I hear some people saying, oh, I bought one too. And then I did yours. And I was like, boy, yours is so much better than the one I bought. And it's like, well, you wasted money to find that out.
Do you have a great deal under contract? Well, submit it to partnerwithpete.com. The Partner with Pete program is a deal funding program where we will actually use our funds to complete the purchase of the property. We will do every other step of the process, including the due diligence, the transaction side, the marketing side, and the transaction on the resale side. And when all the dust settles, we will split the profits 50-50. There is no downside for you as an investor, only upside. So once again, go to partnerwithpete.com, submit your deal there, and let's get it funded.
So back to this question. Clay says double close. I've heard a lot recently about people adding double close into their tool belt for their business. I've got a deal that is a good option for this, but have not done one yet or before. Would love to hear pros and cons from anyone who has done a few double close deals. Also, when doing a double close, what documents have you used to have the right to market it? I assume some kind of power of attorney type document, but curious how these need to be structured.
Okay.
First of all, can you say what a double market is? I mean, a double close.
Double close is basically, as an investor, you get the property locked up under contract, and then you line up a buyer. You don't actually close on the deal. You're basically just making money in between.
So you get it locked up as in a contract to buy it from a seller.
Yeah.
And then while you're in escrow, you then get the have the rights to market it to an end buyer.
Right.
And then
And then the end buyer steps up, brings their money to actually close the deal, and you don't have to bring any money, and then you just make the money in between. So the spread. So I know, Clay, in your comments, you said you've heard a lot of talk about people doing double closes. You haven't heard that talk from me. It's definitely not something that I recommend. I mean, I know it's possible. People make money doing that. But I'll tell you, this business is hard enough as is without getting that extreme level of complication that you're putting yourself into there. First of all, you got to somehow talk to sellers and explain to them how this is good for them. I'm not sure that's a tough road. First of all, there you have to be transparent. I mean, first of all, you got to let them know what you're going to be doing. That you're going to be getting it under contract. You're going to be putting it on the market, trying to find an end buyer, and then they're going to have to wait around for that end buyer to come around. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense from their perspective. So it's tough in that way.
And if you don't, then you don't close it.
Right. Then, you've got to deal. There's a lot of properties that you get under contract with, you spend some time with, and you find out that there's title issues. All right. So that's another complication that you might put in all this effort to find a buyer and do all the stuff, and then you find out there's a bad title to it anyhow. So then you waste all your time.
And two people pissed off at you on both sides.
So say you find an end buyer. Well, first of all, finding the end buyer is going to be difficult because in a lot of states, they're not going to let you actually put that on the market and market it unless you have the deed to the property. That's happened in the past. A lot more agents and things were open to that, but there's been a lot of restrictions put on that lately because of these types of situations.
Well, because it could also look like fraud because you're marketing property you don't actually own.
Yeah.
So, and they're very worried about people taking advantage of other people and saying, I own it.
Right. Exactly. And somehow profiting off it. Yes. And then the other thing is the double close transaction itself. Now, in some states, that's completely not legal. You can't do that. You might find a closing company that may kind of fudge the rules and do that for you. But in some states, that's probably not going to happen. So some states admit double close may be fine as long as it's disclosed. But you're going to have to figure out that nuance and everything. It's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot that the stars really have to align in order for that type of deal to work. And that's why we don't teach it.
Right. And the reason people do it is because they don't have the money to fund it.
Right.
That's the whole reason someone does this. It makes no sense unless you're trying to come up with money you don't have. So a lot of you're just wholesaling.
Yeah, you're wholesaling. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But you're doing, but, yeah, you're kind of not, you're not wholesaling it to another investor right. who will actually close on the purchase. You're trying to wholesale it to the end buyer.
Right. All so. While never actually taking. So what happens in the double close is that the end buyer is the one who, okay, they wire their money to escrow mm-hmm. and then they simultaneously take it. They use that money to do the first one. For a split second, it goes to you. Split second, it goes to that. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things. So you don't need to, though, because you could use Partner with Pete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Partner with Pete. That's exactly. There's a great segue
I'm
there.
I'm leading you. Yes. I'm leading you. I'm giving you.
Partner with Pete. Essentially, what we do is we use our money to fund the deals. So mm-hmm. you don't have to do this type of situation. So what happens is, as an investor, you've got a deal under contract. You submit it to the Partner with Pete program, which is partnerwithpete.com. And we look at it. If it's a deal and it matches our criteria, we'll say, okay, we'll do this deal. We'll fund this deal. And we'll use our own money to close on the deal. And not only that, we'll basically take the baton and run with it from there. We'll handle every other part of the process. And there's a lot of parts of the process, meaning we'll handle all the research of the property. We'll commit any funds needed towards value add, meaning brush clearing or survey or perk test or any of that kind of stuff. And close the deal. And we will then find an agent to resell it for us, do the marketing and everything. And then when the property resells, we split the profits 50-50. So as an investor, there's no downside for you. You don't have to jump through all those weird hoops like that. We actually close it with our money. And it's a win-win scenario.
Very good. Next question. Brent says, resources for staying informed regarding new laws. What tools, resources, apps, or websites that you use to help keep you in the know of any new or pending state federal laws that would affect this business?
Yeah, I would stay real tapped into our land conquest community. Just recently saw someone post something in there about some updates about that were happening in a particular state. But yeah, that's the best way, is to stay networked with other mm-hmm. land investors. You know, people are doing business all over the country and everything. And, you know, and then also your regular title companies and escrow companies, things like that, they'll be on top of that. And if you're attorneys, if you're dealing with attorneys in particular states, they can help you with that as well.
That's another reason why we recommend with you do closings, is that you use an attorney or closing a company, escrow, title, it's whatever it is. That's their job.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, hey, did you hear, if you have a good relationship, that did you hear blah, blah, blah is happening?
So, yeah.
Okay. Kenneth says, HOA or no HOA? I hear a lot of people saying don't pull lists in areas that have HOAs, but why? How do HOAs restrict land? I'd love some real examples instead of just because they restrict you. Thanks. Well, Kenneth, they restrict you.
Yeah, they restrict you. No, I mean, the big deal is, like, it's completely possible to buy and sell and flip land in communities that have HOAs. And we've bought and sold land in, with HOAs, and we just bought one last week. But I don't prefer it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd much rather deal with land that is outside of an HOA. First of all, you know, there's just more complexity to it. You know, you've got an HOA that controls the property in some way. You know, sometimes these restrictions are light. Sometimes they're pretty heavy. They'll tell you exactly what color your garage door needs to be, you know?
So which way it can face.
Which way it can face. We've seen all kinds of crazy stuff. So it's just more difficult. Mm-hmm. There's money to be made in HOAs sometimes. It's just more difficult. And a lot of times it's more difficult to resell. I've noticed as a whole, they take longer to resell these deals because, you know, there's a smaller pool of buyers that are willing to that can buy into the upside of having the HOA and are fine with the restrictions and things like that.
That's the whole reason. It's mm-hmm. just that it restricts your buyers. And also they could say, you know, if it's a community or an area where you're thinking, okay, this land's going to be perfect for a mobile home, like no mobile homes.
Yeah.
Or you can't, it takes 2 years to get through the building process. It's just all about the friction from getting the sellers.
Yeah. And another thing, the mm-hmm. friction there is some of these are gated communities as well. So it makes showings a lot more difficult.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, do it mm-hmm. if you want, if the deal is right, but just know you're going into it.
That's right.
There's more friction or whatever. Okay, Michelle says, Germany. Oh, I like this. Hi, I want to start from my basement in Germany. Okay. Do you know if I can also do it with an international bank, but with German bank account? And how can I get all those EIN and so on? Or what else I need to start from Germany? Thanks so much.
Well, first of all, I know it can be done internationally. And I'm not the expert of telling exactly what you're going to need to do in order to set up a company and everything to do it that way. I know that other investors set up US-based LLCs or corporations mm-hmm. and US-based bank accounts. So I'm not saying it's impossible to use a German bank account or German corporation or something like that, but it's probably going to be a little bit more difficult.
Mm-hmm. So. I think some, like Chase, I think has international offices. There might be backup withholdings or something because you're not a US.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's been a long
time. Yeah, you're going to have to jump through some extra hoops with some of these title companies and things if you're not using a US-based entity mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, you'll have to do an international notaries or sign someone here. Right.
So it may be possible to do it in that way, but just maybe look into what it would take for a, you know, a German citizen to open up a US-based entity.
Right.
That might be your easiest path to deal with that one time rather than to try to go the other route.
I know that it's possible. So don't let that stop you. There's tons of students of ours. Right. And
yeah, lots of people doing it internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say, just do it.
Yeah.
That's Nike's. I'm not trying to steal their quote.
Yes.
And that's awesome. Okay.
Well, great episode. This was good. Inside the business. We need some sort of special music for that. And we'll do other of these kind of an ongoing thing inside the business and breaking down different things as kind of an ongoing feature.
Yeah. But, and be sure to like, share, comment, you know, share the resources with your friends and everything. But if you like this episode, let us know so that we can do more like this. Or if you have questions.
If you hated it, I guess let us know anyhow.
Yeah, don't.
Let us know too. No? Okay.
Yeah, I'm cool. Thanks. Actually, I mean, that would be useful as well in nice terms.
We'll delete your comment.
I don't delete any comments. Someone's like, that's fine, but you have to say it nicely. Like, you're going to say however you want to say it. That's fine. But it was fun for us, and I think we learned a lot building our business.
Sure. So. Yep. That's right.
That's it. Well, we'll see you guys next week.
First of all, before
oh my
you go,
God, yes. Where can they find you?
Yes. You can find me on Instagram, TikTok, at Partner with Pete. On YouTube, if you're listening to this podcast, find us on YouTube at Turning Profit. There's all kinds of other content that we've got on our YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. We're really putting a lot of effort into that. So check us out there. Obviously, landconquest.com, that's where you'll find our community. We're hanging out in there as well. At least I am. I know you read the comments. You don't really comment in there too often.
I like.
Okay. You like. All right. And so that's about it. Oh, and if you want to check out the website for our podcast, that's turningprofit.com. All kinds of income reports and everything there that, you know, I won't even go into that, but there is a wealth of land flipping information on that website there.
You can
as well.
Go down the rabbit trail. But when you talk about the YouTube thing, if you're listening to this on a podcast, I'm a podcast person. I love podcasts, but you like YouTube videos too.
Yes.
So you can actually see it. There's more graphics if that's how it keeps your attention going.
Right, right.
That's something for everyone.
That's right. We got it all. Well, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
All right, bye.
Ready to start turning profit yourself? Head to turningprofit.com to step up your real estate investing game. See you on the next episode.